St. Louis, welcome to another installment of Conduct Detrimental, the St. Louis Rams relocation series. Some good news to report. First and foremost, some numbers. Our three episodes, our trifecta series on the St. Louis Rams relocation lawsuit, our most three popular episodes in the history of our young show. I'm joined for a brief intro by Mike Lawson. What's up, Mike?
What's up, Dan? I'm very, very excited. I'm so happy that we were able to make these town halls work.
So, yeah, if you're reading the subject line of this podcast episode, this is the unfiltered raw audio of our St. Louis town hall. Each panel, we had two of them, went about 2 hours. The first panel, I'm just going to explain it for those that weren't following our flyers and that you should be following our coverage. It's our most popular topic we've ever discussed for obvious reasons. But our first panel was Andrew Brandt, who worked with the Green Bay Packers as their general manager. He's now at he did some work, obviously, within the NFL circles. But then he's now at Villanova. He's the head of their sports program. Huge voice on Twitter and all things social media. Next on the panel, we had Jody Balsam, who was a lawyer once upon a time for the NFL's offices. Now a professor at Brooklyn Law School. And lastly, Tim McKernan, who's the president and co-founder of InsideSt.Louis.com and obviously the host of the Tim McKernan Show. So Tim is our St. Louis plant for this panel. We wanted to make sure we had someone from St. Louis on this as well, so people didn't think we were shilling out to the NFL and having an NFL/team panel. But yeah, that was it for panel one. That's what you're going to hear. We'll talk about panel two later, which is more of our St. Louis panel. It's more St. Louis personalities, but we'll talk about that in the next one. You're just going to hear our run in really unfiltered Zoom. But Mike, I don't know, before we just go straight to the audio, what did you think of our first panel? I know you listened to the whole thing.
I did. I thought it was really excellent. I thought the insight of Jody Balsam into kind of maybe what the NFL's kind of mindset is. She did give a disclaimer, obviously, that she's not speaking on behalf of the NFL. She doesn't work for the NFL anymore. But I think it was really great to get that perspective of the league side. And the same thing with Andrew Brandt. Andrew Brandt, obviously, is the director of the Villanova Sports Law, and he worked for the Green Bay Packers. So coming from a team side, a league side, and then Tim McKernan giving us a St. Louis perspective. I think it really laid out very perfectly like what's happening and what the next steps are and the possibility of the NFL, really the issue that the NFL has that we keep saying is not being brought up enough, that they are possibly on the hook for, billions of dollars.
Mike, you said it well, what will not show up in our audio of this, we'll see if we can figure out the video at some point, will not show up the comments in the chat that were not so nice to Jody. We addressed them in part on the show, but certainly the people of St. Louis are not happy with anyone affiliated with the NFL. So we understand that, but wish we didn't have some of that, but it is what it is. We had some of that a little bit in panel two, which we'll get into, but without further ado, if you want the video next time show up, we'll do another one of these, I'm sure, with Ben Fredrickson, some other big names in St. Louis that were given to us. Jim Quinn, the lawyer for the city of Oakland lawsuit, has expressed an interest in joining our next town hall. So if you guys like this, you like this audio, just let us know. And we're certainly more than happy to do another one of these. You're not going to see the numbers. We had about we had about 500 people register for both events. We had, I think in times, maybe 300 unique visitors to each panel, which was great. It's our first time doing this. Mike, anything else to add before we jump straight into panel one?
I just want to remind you that our podcast is sponsored by Themis. We do have a special link, themisbar.com/condetrimental. You can find out about all of the things that Themis has to offer. Our panels have a plethora of knowledge. Themis has a plethora of knowledge. They are going to get you all of your bases covered. They're going to make sure that you are ready for the MBE, the MEE, the MPT, you name it. They've got unlimited essay grading, 4 MBE style practice exams, you name it, Themis has you covered.
So listen, memo to people that are just coming new to our podcast. Here's the story. Themis reached out and they said, we'd like to sponsor the podcast. We are lawyers here. We have no idea how business works. All we're good at is getting people to pay attention to certain lawsuits. But to the extent that you do want to advertise on our show, we are not opposed to it, right? We just have no effing clue what we are doing with respect to finances. We just run a really cool show here. Listen, we're all happy you came along for the ride. I guess as a final note, so many comments in the chats. You're going to hear with the panelists. Just gratitude for us taking upon this cause. I never, and I'm just speaking very candidly, Mike, Dan and I are two lawyers. Dan's from Florida. I'm from New York. I sometimes talk like, why isn't the national media talking about this? And then, Tim kind of told us offline and he mentioned it in the chat or in the discussion, but, he's saying it was very nice that we picked this up, almost like we have ascended to a level of kind of national status. Cause think about it, Mike, Dan and I go on shows across the country, maybe we are national guys. Maybe that's at this point of this podcast, but we're true national guys. So kind of an inflection point, and really, really cool to see everyone come out, but certainly an overwhelming response on social media and in the chat about the gratitude for us taking on this lawsuit and really providing some hard hitting analysis and answering, you know, some tough questions, good or bad. We're giving you the analysis, you know, from the NFL perspective, from the Rams perspective, from the city of St. Louis perspective. We have no dog in the race. We're just shedding some light on it. So that said, thank you so much for everyone that came. I'm going to shut up now. We're going to go right to the panel, and Mike and I will have some words at the end, kind of debriefing. With that said, let us kick it. Panel number one.
With the relocation guidelines, because kind of they frame the issues for the entire case. And we're going to have a two-part, town hall this morning is going to focus on the NFL relocation guidelines, which were at the heart of everything. And, you know, are really go to the, you know, damages in this case. And the reason why they're so important is that the city of St. Louis is essentially seeking to disgorge the relocation fee from the NFL and to claw back and disgorge the value of the increased value of the Rams franchise by virtue of moving to LA. And when you think about those numbers economically, they kind of get up into the, you know, north of $2 billion. And that's really where the lion's share of the claimed damages are. But they depend on a breach of contract claim, and they depend on an unjust enrichment theory. And both of those theories draw from the relocation guidelines and whether cities, first of all, whether the policy that was enacted by the National Football League in 1984 and 1999, amended in 1999, whether that's a contract at all. And assuming it is a contract between the league and its member teams, are the cities, the home team, the hometowns, are they beneficiaries of that policy such that they can bring a lawsuit? And we're going to get into that during this roundtable discussion. And the importance of the guidelines is that in the absence of being able to enforce the relocation guidelines, what the city of St. Louis is left with as a remedy is essentially a fraudulent misrepresentation claim, which really, when you look at the measure of damages for fraud, we're looking mainly at the amount of money that the city spent pursuing, you know, stadium development plans in, you know, pursuit of a new stadium to satisfy the NFL. That's a much smaller damage number. And of course, punitive damages could also be important. But when we think about the shock value of this case in terms of the number billion or more, and the prospect of an expansion franchise being dangled as a settlement chip, all of that draws upon the notion that the city of St. Louis can pursue a third-party beneficiary claim under the relocation guidelines. And that's a debatable point. A state court in California has held in the Raiders case that it's not a contract and that the city of Oakland is not a third-party beneficiary of that agreement. But we're not in Oakland anymore. We're in St. Louis, Missouri, where Judge McGraw has ruled on two different occasions in denying the NFL's motion to dismiss and in denying the NFL's motion for summary judgment that this thing is a contract and that the city of St. Louis has the rights as a third party beneficiary. And given the rulings of Judge McGraw and the imminent trial date, the issue of the relocation guidelines is going to be front and center in this litigation. And to join us on this roundtable discussion, we have, I think, the three perfect individuals to evaluate and look at the guidelines from three different vantage points. First, we have Professor Jody Balsam from Brooklyn Law School, and I believe you also teach at NYU Law School. Her claim to fame is, besides being one of the most, you know, prominent, nationally recognized sports law attorneys, has been her career focus on issues around the National Football League. She was in-house counsel within the NFL for a long period of time, but don't blame her for the guidelines. She didn't write them. She hasn't gone to court to enforce them, but nobody in the law knows as much about the legal underpinning of the relocation guidelines as Jody Balsam does. So we're going to have her give some kind of a context to how these guidelines came about, because they were not enacted in a vacuum at the whim of Commissioner Tagliabue or Commissioner Roselle. They occurred because of an antitrust case back in the 1980s, and they have a long tortured history going back 40 years. So Jody is going to dive into that aspect of it. Andrew Brandt, who's also a lawyer and runs the sports law program at Villanova Law School, is our second panelist. And he's a longtime NFL insider. Currently, he's a member of the media covering the National Football League and the business of sports for Sports Illustrated. And he dropped an article today on the St. Louis Rams relocation lawsuit. I highly recommend you reading it. But going back to the 1990s and to the 2000s, he covered the business of the NFL, has been in the room for these meetings within NFL circles. He's a true insider, and he's going to kind of apply his experiences to what has happened with the Los Angeles story and bring it forward. And then the third guest is our St. Louis insider, Tim McKernan, who is the co-host of the Tim McKernan Show in the morning after St. Louis on St. Louis Sports Talk Radio. He was at every town hall meeting and knows the history and the trajectory of this debate going all the way back to even when before Stan Kroenke bought the parcel of land in California that later became SoFi Stadium. So we've got three different vantage points, and we're going to complete the story here about these relocation guidelines. So Jody, I begin with you. What are the guidelines? How did they ever come into existence?
Well, first, thank you for having me involved in this town hall. I just have to shout out to you and Dan Lust about the great work you're doing on conduct detrimental. It has become a force in sports law conversation in its very short life. And thank you for engaging so many law students, including students that I teach, in the observation and analysis and writing about breaking sports law developments. You're just doing a great service all around. I also have to say, I'm a lawyer. I need to make my disclaimer. I did work at the NFL. My employment there ran until 2006. I am no longer employed there. I do not speak for them, and nor will I say anything today that reveals anything I learned as an attorney obligated to maintain NFL confidentiality. But that said, I can talk, as I do in my sports law classes, about the origins of the relocation policy. And I would just, it sounds like folks on this town hall are very familiar with the policy. So maybe you already have cited this language in it, but I would just ask you to focus for a minute on a key statement in the policy in which it says, and it's a hint to the origins of the policy, in which the policy says that control of team location is a matter for league members to determine jointly according to rules established and applied by the league. And then it goes on to say, I'm sorry, this is a statement in the joint policy entered into between the NFL and the United States Conference of Mayors. I misspoke a minute ago. This is part of the statement that the joint principles agreed upon by the league and a conference of municipal leaders about how the league should evaluate team relocation requests. And the policy goes on to say the U.S. Conference of Mayors and the league recognize that antitrust litigation complicates the issues surrounding team relocation, and that absent antitrust immunity granted legislatively in some form, absent antitrust immunity, the league may not be able to implement certain procedures set forth in this statement of principles. So that right there gives you a hint to why this relocation policy even exists. And I will say that I'm not alone in this crowd, and I frankly don't believe I'm alone amongst folks who have ever worked at league headquarters in having incredible sympathy for the fans, businesses, community of cities like St. Louis who lose sports teams through relocation that is financially driven and that does not respect their investment emotionally and otherwise in their local team. And frankly, that's the starting point for this story. That's where the NFL started in 1981, with that degree of intense respect and honoring local teams, local fans, host towns, hometowns, investment in their local teams. When the Raiders came and said, we want to leave Oakland and move to Los Angeles. And the league invested years and resources and money to fight that relocation in an antitrust suit that was filed in Los Angeles that ultimately resulted in a court decision that let loose the era of franchise free agency. The Raiders, in opposition to the league's wishes and the other member clubs' wishes, forced a relocation to Los Angeles by virtue of being able to bring an antitrust suit. What is an antitrust suit? I will oversimplify egregiously here. In the case of the Raiders, it's an accusation that competing firms in a market have colluded to restrain competition. And the Raiders' claim was that the other member clubs of the NFL, in exercising their right under the NFL constitution and bylaws to stop the Raiders from relocating, were in effect engaging in collusion to restrain a free market in sports team relocation. And what the antitrust laws have done over time is through these private lawsuits brought largely by the teams who wanted to relocate, has forced the hands of the leagues and compelled them to permit relocation, even though the leagues and the other member clubs did not think it was in the best business interest of the leagues. One of the outcomes of the Raiders suit, part of the Ninth Circuit Appellate Court's decision affirming liability for the league and its member clubs in the Raiders lawsuit, was a recommendation that leagues need to operate in the franchise relocation realm in an orderly fashion with stated guidelines that objectively evaluate the merits of a relocation and basically give the league something to hook their antitrust defense on, that we are not acting with any intent to harm competition in any way. We are acting according to objective relocation guidelines that justify or not allowing a team to move. And that's the origin of the league's relocation guidelines. I'll stop there because I'm sure Andrew has a perspective on this as well.
Well, I can't hear Andrew, but I will ask you a question. You raised a joint statement of principles that was entered into in 1996 between the National Football League and the national, you called it the National Conference of Mayors.
U.S. Conference of Mayors.
U.S. Conference of Mayors, which represent host cities. Now, you and I have had an offline conversation about the importance of that joint statement of principles. I view it as sort of an active, collaborative role together. And, you know, the NFL may have been responding to the antitrust concerns raised by the Ninth Circuit in the Raiders number one case in 1984. But the guidelines that are at issue today were enacted in 1999, and the discussions between the cities and the NFL went on for a couple of years. It began with this joint statement of principles, which was a jointly executed document, and the guidelines that later became the amended guidelines were originally included in this joint statement of principles. So should it matter for purposes of enforcing the NFL relocation policy, whom they're intended to benefit? I would think that the cities are obviously an interested party. They played a role in negotiating these guidelines, and the guidelines that are now in effect were laid down initially in these joint statement of principles, which according to Commissioner Tagliabue and according to the amended policy were incorporated within the amended relocation policy. So does that reflect an exalted or elevated role or elevated private interest for the cities to be able to enforce these policies? Because you could have all these great criteria, but if the NFL doesn't follow them to the T, or they misinterpret them or just pay lip service to it, who's going to enforce it?
Well, I will say that you're raising a separate question of law, which is when does a document like the relocation policy establish contractual rights? And more specifically, when does a document like the relocation policy establish contractual rights on behalf of somebody not party to that contract, a third party beneficiary? And that's a whole other discussion, but I really want to step back for a minute and let somebody else jump in.
Sure, I filled the void because I didn't hear Andrew, so I jumped in with what would have been my question 20 minutes from now. Andrew, go ahead.
Yeah, I didn't know if I should take it from Jody or let you.
No, it was intended for you. Obviously, we've choreographed this so well, all the rehearsals.
I know, we've had so much time here. I just want to echo Jody first. You and Dan really have done a great job, and I know a lot of people know me, and I maybe get more attention than these guys because I have a bigger platform. But I just think that it's so necessary in my world, sports law, sports business, because of my background, which I'll talk about in a minute. My media goes much more towards the business side, and I don't get caught up in the legal side, even though I am a lawyer and run a sports law program, and I'll be teaching sports law in about an hour. I just think that what Dan and Dan do is such a service, and I really appreciate it. What, and my students do too, big time. My background, as many of you know, I was an agent for many years at a law school representing players, and then I switched sides. As agents would tell you, I went to the dark side. I moved to Green Bay, Wisconsin. You can see the helmet back there. And for 10 years, was vice president of the Packers. Where I can give a lot of maybe texture to this conversation without knowing the rules, because as much as I was in the league, I never got, of course, the Packers are the one team that is never, ever going to relocate. So we never had to consult these rules. But I do remember going to meetings. From my first meeting in 1999 to my last in 2009, I just remember there was agenda items in these meetings always, like at least once a year, about moving a team to LA. It was clearly a priority to have a team in the second largest market. It was clearly something that owners wanted. The problem was, all along, there was no stadium and or financing solution. And we heard about potential sites, the Raiders in Irwindale, and we heard about Sacramento, and we heard about all these places, but it wasn't downtown LA and there was no financing. Then we sort of hear about Stan Kroenke buying some land in LA. And I remember that vividly, and I think I was the one at a press conference, now I was covering it for ESPN, when I asked Roger Goodell about that at a Super Bowl press conference. And he said something like, yeah, Stan's a billionaire, he buys a lot of land. And then I think Kevin Demoff, you know, is quoted in the pleadings as saying, that's not for football, that doesn't work. So that raised some eyebrows. And then I remember covering the meetings for ESPN in 2016, January, February, where the fateful meetings in Houston, where it was awarded, the Rams won the three-team sweepstakes. You know, I talk about this a lot. I don't understand it. I've been around meetings a long time, ownership meetings. You can count on one hand, less than one hand, how many times an ownership vote, meaning all 32 teams, goes against, I repeat, against the committee assigned to the issue's recommendations. So competition committee, they'll recommend, you know, replay or not replay. They'll recommend this emphasis or not emphasis. And membership will rubber stamp it. In this case, it was called the Committee on LA Assignment or whatever it was called, recommended they take the Carson site. It was Raiders and Chargers are going to Carson, California. Disney CEO Bob Iger's there lobbying for it. It was all good. Something happened that fateful day in those meetings in Houston where the room changed. Stan Kroenke's a reclusive owner. No one really knew him, but Jerry Jones, everyone knew him. And with his gusto and bravado, he turned the room. He thought, yeah, we shouldn't be in Carson. We gotta be in LA, and Stan's got the money and let's do it. So it turned. And all of a sudden we come out of those meetings in Houston where the team going to LA is the Rams. And they're not going to Carson, they're going to Inglewood. And there's this big thought about, we're going to have NFL combine, we're going to have NFL meetings, we're going to have NFL offices, we're going to have NFL network, we're going to have the Olympics, we're going to have World Cup. And all of a sudden it took a life of its own. But it's interesting because here we are 4 years into a litigation. I don't remember much about the fact that, oh yeah, St. Louis is left behind. It seemed to be a fait accompli that St. Louis, San Diego, and Oakland were done. Like, these three teams came into the meetings, like, take us, LA, our membership, please give us LA. And then, of course, Oakland and San Diego were sent back, you know, patted on the back, and said, go do what you got to do. This was an interesting sidelight to those meetings. And then, of course, it happened. So I'm not sure, you know, the way I understand what happened in St. Louis was that there was a feeling that the NFL needed to be in LA. The NFL was getting to LA. San Diego and Oakland joined up on a suburban site. Owners, through Jerry Jones bargaining and other means, didn't want to be in a suburban site. They wanted to be in downtown LA in Inglewood, and Kroenke had the money. What was left behind was an abandoned city. And, you know, the guidelines, as I'm understanding primarily from you guys, Dan and Dan, you know, were the guidelines a contract? Were the guidelines rock solid? Was there, you know, there's testimony about Roger Goodell saying they're mandatory. What did St. Louis do or not do? You know, but again, from a league standpoint, from a coverage standpoint for ESPN, I'm like, well, this was done. You know, this was over. Like, I don't know where in the process it was where St. Louis was still in the picture, because when they came to those meetings, it was over.
Yeah, so Andrew, this brings up the issue of good faith. I mean, if you read the relocation, you know, criteria, the guidelines, the words good faith, you know, are kind of replete throughout that. There's an obligation on behalf of the league and the team seeking to relocate to act in good faith with the incumbent city. And I want to turn this to Tim McKernan, who is a St. Louis native and has been closely following this story. And I think it's not going to be surprising to Tim to hear from you that this was a fait accompli within league circles. But Tim, what was going on in St. Louis during this time frame? And can you speak to the issue of the league's and the Rams' sort of actions and intent and good faith towards the city of St. Louis?
Absolutely. And with regards to what both Jody and Andrew have said with what you and Dan are doing, we in St. Louis, I know, are very grateful for it, because we feel like for the first time nationally, people are hearing about a story that we've been aware of for years. And while it strikes me as relatively obvious as to why some of the more prominent NFL reporters have not been covering it, it's something that's refreshing to see it finally get attention. This story starts well before January 2016 in Houston, when it was a fait accompli, although I would agree with you, Andrew, that it was a fait accompli. The city of St. Louis, unlike the city of Oakland and the city of San Diego, did put a stadium proposal forth, and it was approved by the St. Louis City Board of Aldermen. The governor, Jay Nixon, along with Dave Peacock and Bob Blitz, who is representing the plaintiffs in this case, put the task force together. However, I believe that was an inconvenient truth for the NFL, because for a number of years, I would say at the very least 2013, perhaps before, when Stan Kroenke exercised his right of first refusal with Shad Khan in 2010, the Rams, as in Kroenke, Demoff, knew that they were going to go back to Los Angeles. And whether that was 2013 or 2010, that's up for debate. But what infuriates people in St. Louis is how around the country, it's just been kind of accepted that, oh, St. Louis didn't support its NFL team. St. Louis has lost two NFL teams in a matter of 30 years, and they must be bad fans, and it's a dying city. And that's a misrepresentation of St. Louis. It's a misrepresentation of what actually transpired in St. Louis. And it's a narrative that I believe has been framed in part by Stan Kroenke in his exit statement the night before, conveniently, the vote in Houston. In other words, let's burn it down so we can't come back and make sure we get the vote that we expect to get in Houston, because it was indeed a fait accompli. It was going to be the Chargers and Rams. And we knew that. I don't know if you guys knew it, but we knew it before the vote even took place. And Andrew, it's wonderful to hear somebody say what you just said, which is how revolutionary it was for the committee on the Los Angeles relocation to recommend Carson 5-1, and then the vote be for Inglewood. I went to Inglewood. I went to Carson. I went and met with the San Diego mayor at the time, Kevin Falconer. So I was on the ground and having firsthand conversations and viewing all these places and talking to people. So I knew that the fix was in. But around the league, it's like, well, St. Louis stole the Rams and they're not supporting the Rams because they're a horrible franchise and they're horrible fans. And so it's only right that they go back to Los Angeles, and St. Louis must be a dying city that doesn't deserve an NFL team. And that is what I take issue with. I can't speak with any authority to any legal element. I went to journalism school and I'm 8 hours short of an undergrad degree. So I'm in the back of the classroom with you guys, but I can talk about what did take place because I saw it with my own eyes. And when I went to Carson and I met with the mayor of Carson, he said he's going to give me a tour of the site. And I show up at Carson that day. This is October of 2015. And I get to the security gate and the guy at the security gate goes, "Oh, who are you?" And I said, "I'm Tim McKernan. I'm here per the mayor of Carson to get a tour of the stadium site." He goes, "Stadium site?" He goes, "It's a landfill." And I go, "Well, I've been told this is where they're going to build the Raiders and Chargers stadium." He goes, "You might've been told that, but this is a landfill." So I get a tour of it. And I was getting a tour of a landfill. I drive down to San Diego. Kevin Faulkner, the mayor, is getting mic'd up and he goes, "How are things up in LA?" I go, "Well, I just was in Carson and I get the sense that that's not really real." And he kind of mumbles under his breath. He goes, I'd trust your instincts on that one." So he knew in San Diego that it wasn't real, even though they were being held up by Spanos. And their thought process was, "We're going to build something at Mission Valley where Qualcomm, Jack Murphy, whatever it was called at the time, is." And then the Chargers would say, "Well, we want something downtown." But if they said, "We'll build something downtown," then the Chargers would say something, "We want at Mission Valley." They weren't going to win, just like we weren't going to win in St. Louis. Why? Because Stan Kroenke was the only one who could privately finance a stadium and get the NFL back in Los Angeles. Spanos wasn't liquid enough to do it. Davis wasn't liquid enough to do it. They probably didn't want him to be the captain of the ship anyway. And so it was going to be Kroenke, and they were going to force the legislation all the way through no matter what. And St. Louis was going to be left holding the bag. And that's fine. That's business. Unlike a lot of my peers in St. Louis, I don't have a problem with that. It's capitalism. That's the name of the game. The problem I have with it is this misrepresentation of the way things went down, that St. Louis didn't come to the table and that the people of St. Louis were not supporting the Rams. This was Major League, the movie, applied to football so that Stan Kroenke could justifiably go to Los Angeles and St. Louis could be looked at as a bad sports city. And that's BS. And the people in St. Louis know it. And that's why we're grateful around the country. Some people, still many aren't, but some people are starting to talk about what really took place. You want to increase your wealth and move to LA? Fine. But don't crap on us out the door. That's BS.
Yeah, but Tim, you highlighted that, Los Angeles, or I'm sorry, the Rams might find that their economic fortunes are going to be much greater in Los Angeles. And I'm going to direct this question to any of you, Jody, Andrew, or Tim, but the guidelines, the almighty guidelines that the NFL is insulated from, state that Article 4.3 confirms that no club has an entitlement to relocate simply because it perceives an opportunity for enhanced club revenues in another location. But if that's exactly what happened here, where do you go? What remedy can there be? And I know I keep getting, this is a court case that's going to go to trial in early January, and we can debate whether the guidelines were even adhered to, who makes that decision. But if you have these relocation criteria to ward off the possibility or potential of antitrust liability at the recommendation of the Ninth Circuit, at what point are these guidelines nothing more than meaningless criteria that the league can bend at its will to suit the result it wants?
Well, I'll tell you what, I think the first thing to ask is what contract actually exists? Is there a contract at all embedded in these guidelines or any of the procedures around the NFL evaluating a team relocation, right? That's the first question that you have to answer. And I would say the contract that exists is an agreement between amongst the member clubs expressly written into the league constitution that requires a three-quarter vote to permit a team relocation. That's a contract that exists. Everything else is policy, right? And what that policy tries to do is allow for that vote to take place in an orderly, objective, rational fashion. And the policy itself says your obligation, member clubs, in applying this policy is to the league and all other member clubs to advance the interests of the league in its home territories. That's what your obligation is here. Everything else are, frankly, just an amorphous promise to consider certain criteria in exercising the contractual right to vote on team relocations. And, you know, frankly, the idea that a municipality asserts a third-party beneficiary contractual right in this setting is doesn't really hold water, right? So when you look at the law of third-party beneficiaries, what the law requires you to do is ask, what was the intent of the parties to the underlying contract? So even if the relocation policy layered on top of the league constitution and bylaws is a contract, what third-party beneficiary law requires the court to do is say, okay, what was the intent of the parties to this contract? Did they intend to hand over or share contractual enforcement rights with some other third parties? Was it understood and agreed by the parties to this contract that this other third party would have these rights? I doubt very much that any member club or the league could ever be shown to have intended to hand over enforcement rights, right? So this is not about what the third party understood, what the home towns or the US Conference of Mayors understood. That's not the inquiry here. The inquiry is what did the contracting parties understand? And it's very doubtful that you can establish they understood they were handing over third party beneficiary rights to cities. And frankly, in the US Conference of Mayors statement, there is an acknowledgement in the acknowledgement of the antitrust context that they were not expecting any such third party beneficiary rights. And the current chair of the Mayor's Business Council of the US Conference of Mayors is Las Vegas Mayor Carolyn Goodman. Do you think she, or frankly, any of the, her fellow mayors who function through the US Conference of Mayors, want the assertion of third-party contractual rights to be vindicated in court? Think about the incentives, or rather disincentives, it would create for the US Conference of Mayors if its collaborations with private business interests and the input it offers into private business practices were routinely construed to confer on municipalities third-party business, third-party beneficiary rights. I mean, that would entirely undermine the mission of the U.S. Conference of Mayors to work collaboratively with private industry.
Yeah, Jody, I want to push back on a couple of things just to play devil's advocate here. You say one very important thing at the beginning, that within the article, or within Article 4.3 or Article 8, 4.3, there is a contractual relationship between the league and its member clubs, but you
and say among the member clubs.
And you cut that relationship off, or the obligation is only as to the three-quarter vote. And everything that comes afterwards relative to the criteria is just not contractual. I've read through the policy, and after you get past the vote part, there's language about each club's primary obligation to the league and to all other member clubs is to advance the interest of the league in its home territory. This primary obligation, and the word obligation, includes but is not limited to maximizing fan support, including attendance in its home territory. So there's obligatory language that goes beyond the requirement to have three quarters approval. So if we can agree that, for the sake of argument, that this is a contractual relationship, at least between the NFL, its member clubs, and among the member clubs, let's go back to analyzing the issue of who is an intended beneficiary of this. And you speak of the Las Vegas mayor and the current mayor, and we're not talking about circumstances in 2021. This was a document that was executed jointly between the NFL and the U.S. Conference of Mayors in 1996, roughly 25 years ago. And the negotiators at the time were New Orleans Mayor Marc Morial, who was president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. And the Minnesota mayor was the chair of, I guess, the sports committee. And the two of them took the lead on the active negotiations with the NFL. And the criteria that we see in the policy today were initiated in the document to which the city of the Conference of Mayors was a party. So it raises questions of intent, what the NFL intended, what the U.S. Conference of Mayors intended. We have incorporation by reference of this joint statement of principles in the amended relocation guidelines. We have Paul Tagliabue's testimony before Congress that the league incorporated the statement of principles in its guidelines. And most importantly, we have a letter from NFL Vice President Joe Brown addressed to U.S. Conference of Mayors President Mark Morial saying that these guidelines, these relocation criteria are designed to balance and protect the interests of the cities, the NFL and its member teams. And going back to some of the statements in the mayor's conference, you plucked some language that could be construed in the light most favorable to the NFL's position. But to be fair, there's also countervailing or contrary language, such as the joint statement of principles declaration that the relocation rules should recognize the public interest to enjoy the direct and indirect benefits of having a professional sports franchise. And in the correspondence from Mayor Morial to Joe Brown, he acknowledges or says that this is designed to give city interests a measure of greater recognition and protection. So I'm not trying to win the battle of I'm right, you're wrong. These are factual questions.
So I have no dog in this hunt. I'm here just to give you my take on what I think the law would require. And as I said, the law would require to impose third-party beneficiary obligations far more than is in this record. And it's even difficult to understand what is the nature of the obligation asserted, right? So is the obligation asserted the requirement that the NFL consider these criteria, consider these factors? And how do you calibrate what degree of consideration is adequate to fulfill the obligation? What mm-hmm. would a breach of that obligation of consideration look like? I don't think St. Louis is arguing that the NFL breached whatever third-party obligation they had to the city by virtue of simply relocating the team, right? They're not arguing that they're entitled to an NFL team in perpetuity. What they're arguing is that there is some process that should have been followed that they don't believe was adequately followed. And that is much too amorphous a promise to rise to the level of a contractual duty.
But you have criteria. Anyway, Andrew, I want to turn to you for a second.
I just want to make
more than a second. What do you have to do? Do you have anything that you want to add to that? I mean, this is the great debate in St. Louis that's going to go before a jury on January 10th. And we have competing views. And is there an answer?
I don't know if there is. I mean, I think this is the billion-dollar question, or as you would say, multi-billion-dollar question. I do think, sort of the elephant in the room is what we should probably spend a little time on, which is the power of the NFL owners, because it's been so much in display this week with the other case that bubbles up out of nowhere, which is the emails. And somehow, some way, an email from 10 years ago of an ESPN broadcaster brings him down, yet we don't hear anything about the emails involved in the actual issue, which is the Washington football team and their toxic and sexual harassment workplace. Anyway, I am sure these owners understand that they've had these losses so far in this case. What I'm not sure about is whether they're quaking in their boots. And this is what, we're going to find out. They have taken this tack to delay, as you know so well, Dan, delay, not respond to discovery requests, not turn over financial information. And we know this group, as I know as well as anyone, is used to winning, is used to not hearing the word no. And if they don't win, they'll appeal. And if they don't appeal on the win, they'll appeal again, and they'll delay and delay and delay and delay. So I think the real question we're trying to figure out is the NFL in some real trouble here? I think they're in more trouble than some of these other big cases that really threatened their policies in the past, such as Maurice Claret threatening the whole draft eligibility, such as Deflategate threatening the whole Roger Goodell commissioner power, even the the lockout case threatening the way they can lock out people while they bargain, because we're dealing with a jury trial and because they've won motions all along the way. But there's a long way from winning motions along the way to winning a multi-billion dollar lawsuit. So, you know, I've talked to Dan Lust about this. Is the fact that the judge won't move the jury case out of St. Louis, and of course it's going to be on friendly jury, the big bad NFL, we know that. Is that going to be an issue during jury selection? Is that going to be an issue on appeal? Is this going to delay even more? Are we really having a trial in January? Is it, you know, I guess I get the sense that the NFL is not fearing this as much as maybe others are.
Yeah, you know, I think all the cases that you refer to, Andrew, were before appellate courts and questions of law before judges. This is a jury trial, and I think the NFL should be quaking in its boots. The St. Louis, you know, courts have a reputation. I was talking to a fellow commercial litigator in St. Louis, and there's a ranking of different jurisdictions. It sounds like an insulting name. I guess the website is called Judicial Hellhole. And it's some defendant's bar that ranks, you know, cities by like the most problematic. If you're defending a lawsuit in the jurisdiction, St. Louis is the seventh ranked in those rankings. So I think the NFL really should, have concerns about facing a Missouri jury anywhere within the state, having factual questions that are bundled up in some of these questions as to whether there was a contract, whether there was a third party beneficiary status, to the extent that there's any ambiguity along any of those questions, then you bring in extrinsic evidence, the surrounding circumstances. These guidelines have a history that go back 30, 40 years, and there's a lot to consider here. And this might be an ultimate mixed question of law and fact, and to take an argument like this, or to take this risk all the way to trial and to bank on an appellate reversal, ignores the deference and the, you know, just the exalted manner in which appellate courts accord jury findings, particularly when there's a factual element to their findings. So anyway, it's really a high risk game of it's a multi-billion dollar bet. And you know, with the trial a couple of weeks away, I want to turn to Tim again to sort of give us a little bit more of the stadium proposal and the background to what went on in St. Louis, you know, throughout this 2012-2016 time period. I mean, didn't St. Louis put forth a stadium proposal, and, you know, they couldn't even keep their team despite all these good faith efforts. So can you provide our audience with a little bit more of the sort of the surrounding circumstances in the background that existed before the relocation decision, from the St. Louis vantage point?
Sure. And it's a great question, and I'm grateful that we have the opportunity to discuss it beyond St. Louis, just because I don't know how many people beyond St. Louis are even aware that St. Louis, unlike Oakland and unlike San Diego, put a stadium proposal on the table. And so therefore, St. Louis was trying to keep its franchise. And what does it say to other markets, whether you want to pick on Buffalo right now, perhaps inevitably Jacksonville, whoever? If you do put a stadium proposal on the table, you can be told, well, that's not good enough, and we still can leave. St. Louis's position is that Stan Kroenke never came to the negotiating table, and that the design was to get to Los Angeles, and he was just going to, once the arbitrator ruled in the Rams' favor, that they that those plans that the Rams put forth were the ones that St. Louis had to adhere to. The issue with that was, if St. Louis would have done those $700 million worth of renovations to the Dome and that arbitration ruling in 2013, it only would have kept the Rams in St. Louis through 2025. And so you're essentially building a brand new stadium, $700 million worth, but you're only getting them for another decade. And that was why that didn't take place. So with regards to the situation in St. Louis, Andrew, you might remember when the Rams announced Jeff Fisher as their head coach in January 2012. That was the last time Stan Kroenke spoke on the record in St. Louis. And after that press conference, the following morning on our show, I asked one of my co-hosts, I said, what was your takeaway from the Jeff Fisher press conference? January 2012. Remember, they didn't move until January 2016. He goes, well, the Rams are moving. I said, yep, that was my takeaway as well. We saw it coming from that point forward, not because we're soothsayers. We just saw what was going on. And then he buys the land in 2013. Now, to Kroenke's credit, which are words that are not often said in the St. Louis area these days, but to Kroenke's credit, he never talked. Why Kevin Demoff was running around talking and just blatantly lying is beyond me. I would imagine the NFL isn't too happy that he was doing it. I would imagine Stan Kroenke isn't too happy he was doing it. But at the same time, he's Stan Kroenke's employee. So Stan Kroenke still answers for him. But for the next few years, when we were hosting our show and the Rams would win or more often lose a game by substantial margins, but of course, that was the fans of St. Louis's fault, we would be told, why are you guys talking about the Rams moving? You know, they played a game yesterday. Well, what does it matter? This is the biggest story in St. Louis sports happening before our eyes, and nobody else is talking about it. Another NFL franchise is going to move. That's huge. That's more important than them losing by 30 to the Seahawks. And so we would watch this. And in 2014, Mayor James Butts won re-election in Inglewood. And there is an Inglewood newspaper. I'm not sure of its exact name. It wasn't the LA Times, but an Inglewood paper. And at his reelection celebration, getting, I guess, all excited about the fact that he had won, he goes, and I'm meeting with NFL owners tomorrow. And that gets forwarded to me. That's pretty important considering Kroenke just bought land there. And we start talking about it on the show. Magically, within a couple of hours, that quote is removed from the Inglewood paper's website. I go out there in October of 2015. I've scheduled a meeting with James Butts, the mayor, to get a tour of the Inglewood site, which absolutely looks like they're building a stadium and in the process of demoing. And the day before, his assistant emails me and says, oh, he's just been appointed to some Metro Transit board and he will not be available. And I said, okay, well, I'm available tomorrow. He said, oh, he's not going to be available tomorrow. I said, you know what? I'm going to stay in LA for the next 3 months because I knew what was going on. I'll be available any of the next 90 days for Mayor Butts. And I never heard from Mayor Butts again. There was a concentrated attempt to slide that which was really going on under the table so that they could do that which they thought was inevitable. St. Louis wouldn't come to the table with a plan and we could rubber stamp Stan Kroenke going to Inglewood. St. Louis threw a big wrench in the whole plan when St. Louis came to the table with a stadium plan. And that to me is the thing that the NFL wasn't expecting. Now, I know from talking with people with the Rams that they're like, I don't even know why St. Louis is coming to the table with a plan. They know we're not going to accept it. But perhaps St. Louis's reasoning, guys, was, well, okay, we know what you're doing. So here's our only solution. Our recourse is we're going to put forth a stadium plan. Maybe the stadium is real. Maybe it's not. But San Diego and Oakland aren't. And therefore, we're going to put a stadium plan on the table. And therefore, when you do what we know you're going to do, and that is move to Los Angeles, we will have our chance to remedy this in court. Either way, something was going on well before January in Houston. But for the life of me, I still have no idea why Carson was voted 5-1. And that's the only thing in this whole thing in the poker hand I can't figure out.
Well, I'm gonna jump in quick. I want to say, Tim, if we didn't know anything about your background and I just heard your voice, I would assume you worked in radio. I just we got to be mindful a little bit of time. And I will say, listen, our first event, we only had one Zoom bomber, the Vikings fan. He did it twice and I locked the chat. You can send your questions to me. All the hate mail is only coming to me, guys. So let's go a little bit easy. So we are being mindful of time. I know, Andrew, you have your class, and we're going to continue the panel with Tim and Jody, myself and Dan Wallach. Andrew, the floor is yours. Go ahead. I know you wanted to have some kind of parting thoughts.
Yeah, and I have a question for Andrew real quick.
Andrew, I fixed the mute button. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm unmuted now. I do have to go teach, and obviously this will be a part of the topics as well. Just to plug some of my stuff, because maybe some of you want to follow other stuff. I have the column out on this subject at Sports Illustrated. I'm going to podcast about it and Gruden this week on the Business of Sports podcast. I have a newsletter that comes out every week. I'll drop the the link to that to sign up in a chat to Dan, and he can send it out. As well as I started twitching now. So on Thursday night football, Amazon slash.
Is that a medical condition, Andrew? You're okay?
Twitching for the first time. I'm twitching. I go to Twitch and I give you my insights, commentary, chat during the game every Thursday night now.
You mean, so I don't need to rely on the Mannings ESPN2 stream? I can now follow you instead?
Yeah, it's going to be a little bit less people following me, Jody, I think, than the Mannings, maybe a few. But I'll also drop the link to Live on Twitch. But thanks so much, guys.
We'll share it. Listen, if you have a minute or two, Andrew, before I turn to Jody, I mean, there's been a lot of news and reporting by Mike Florio lately about the behind the door, I guess, private conversations within the NFL corridors about possibly settling this case with the lure of a future expansion franchise. So I ask you, as someone who's been in the room and knows so many of these executives and owners, from a settlement standpoint, how does this work? The lawyers are going to be negotiating this. How are all the different entities, and you know, the stadium authority, the city, the NFL, how do you settle a case with 32 teams, 32 plus owners and owner reps, the league, the stadium authority, the city? Is this something that can be navigated? How does it work? And for Jody, I'll ask the same question after you finish the answer.
Yeah, I mean,
it's going to be complicated.
It's complicated, and the only thing I can compare it to that, I followed, and it was the beginnings of it when I was in the league and then covering it for ESPN, is that the global concussion settlement, where all the NFL membership had to agree on a global MDL concussion settlement that would affect 20,000 plus retirees. And again, you're right. Lawyers come to the meetings, lawyers have conference calls. Everybody's seeing, here's our risk, here's our reward. They can be, you know, we can tie them up for 2 years in court, or we can do this. Here's our chances. You know who the firms are. Everybody out there knows who the firms are, the biggest, the best, the most expensive, the Covington and Burlings, the Bakers. All these firms are representing the NFL, and they're going to give their opinions on this. Again, Roger Goodell's job, it sounds trite, but hurting 32 cats, got to build consensus, got to have these people agree on everything, 31 plus us hayseeds that were in Green Bay, Wisconsin. So us cheeseheads. So that's the goal. And again, no real insights there other than the lawyers and the ownership get together, and membership, as they're called, to make this happen or not.
Okay, thank you very much, Andrew. I know you have to go. Really appreciate your time today. Jody, I'm going to turn to you. You've been sort of in the NFL corridors for a long time, and you understand how the league works. How is a settlement, how is a global settlement like this, if it does happen, can you walk us through the timeline, the process, and the prospects for making this happen?
So I don't really have much to add to Andrew's description. I mean, he's been in the room when it happened. And, the one thing I would say is that to add to that description is that the league is always very concerned about setting a precedent that however it resolves a dispute, whether it's being litigated in court or grieved in front of an arbitrator or negotiated with the union, they want to make sure that the long-term interests of the sport and of obviously their financial future is safeguarded, that they will not simply settle a case to make it go away, whatever it takes, without considering the long-term implications and whether it's setting any kind of bad precedent or whether there will be any sort of unintended consequences.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are other values to settling a case like this. We're hearing now about the 650,000 emails in connection with the Washington football team investigation, which has now cost John Gruden, his job. And the league has seen the risk of its inner dialogue going public. So is there what's the potential value? And this is an audience question from Mark's phone to everyone, but what is the potential value to the NFL of keeping similar dialogue out of this case? And what does this case pose in terms of that kind of a risk?
So that
I've
is
actually I've actually inserted myself on the panel. I just for our symmetry purposes, I like this quad box view. But go ahead, Jody.
Well, do you have something you want to contribute to that point?
No, you were about to answer it so gracefully. I just wanted to announce my presence so people weren't
over here. Well, it's always an issue, especially with high profile litigants who, even in the best of times, are the focus of a continual media spotlight, that they don't want the private workings of the organization to be exposed through litigation. They don't want the burden, the expense, the distraction, and the embarrassment that might come with having their inner workings exposed through the pretrial discovery process, through trial testimony. So, you know, that's always a concern. I wouldn't know whether it's more of a concern in this particular litigation, because I don't have access, or I'm not privy to the league's secrets, right? I don't know what they might be concerned or afraid of in this particular case, but it is clearly a general concern in any litigation involving high profile entities like the NFL.
All right, thanks, Jody. Turning to the other side of the coin when it comes to a settlement, Tim, you're plugged into, you know, the mindset, you know, and sort of feeling and sentiment within St. Louis. There's been some reporting lately about an expansion team being a settlement chip to, you know, settle this lawsuit. And this was reporting by Mike Fleury of Pro Football Talk. Is there sentiment in the city? You talked about a stadium plan that was put together, number of years ago. Is there support for an NFL franchise in terms of the financing of it? Would the community coalesce around a new franchise as a possible settlement here, instead of just going to trial and taking the NFL, to the cleaners in terms of monetary damages? Does the city want a new franchise as a settlement? Is that what this battle is about?
Isolating it to fans, which is all I know I can speak for, it would be speculative for me to speak for city government or corporate sponsorship. But from a fan standpoint, Dan, we put a poll up on our fan page for our radio show. And if my memory serves, about 75% said they would welcome the NFL back despite what took place with Stan Kroenke, with the exit, with feeling like the fix was in. I know there are plenty of people, however, would say if St. Louis can get whatever the dollar figure is that is in the realm of reality, and certainly that's a wide delta at this moment as to what we hear, this city would be better served by using that money, minus whatever the attorneys get, to fix various issues, or attempt to begin to fix various issues that the city of St. Louis and the metropolitan area are facing. And we have a baseball team that gets support like close to nobody else in the game, perhaps minus, I think, the Dodgers were only ahead of them in attendance this year with the Cardinals. The Blues have a passionate fan base, and now we have a new MLS franchise. And so some say, why not invest in those franchises where we know we can buy in, as opposed to the NFL, which has done the region wrong. So it's a polarizing discussion in St. Louis. I don't know if people would think it's a slam dunk either way. It's about 75%, but I mean, that's from our show audience. I think you guys would agree that if you took this to the population, most people aren't sports fans, and they might say, well, I'll just arbitrarily assign $500 million net from this, we can do a lot more with that than an NFL team. Others would say, well, get an NFL team over the long term, that's going to multiply and have greater resources to St. Louis than a $500 million lump sum. So it's certainly a divided topic amongst St. Louisans right now.
So we have a question from the crowd. Tim, I think this is probably directed to you. The question is by Ned Reynolds, who's at 96.9.
Oh, they're a very talented sports radio host in Springfield, Missouri. Yep.
I don't know if you guys know each other. I'm not inside on this joke, but he wants to know if Kenny Strode's involvement in the Rams in St. Louis during their time there helped to add to their reasons to move. He cleared many markets in his time there. I can't tell if that's an inside joke, but I feel okay asking it.
No, it's wonderful that you asked it. I don't think Kenny, who goes by the name Iggy, I don't think he had anything to do with it, but I certainly can understand Ned asking the question.
So here's my version of the question, which I told Ned I would ask. So my question, Tim, and I'll give you a little bit of a shout out. In doing our research for our trifecta or superfecta of podcasts now, and obviously this will lead a whatever the version of hitting five horses in a row is. Somebody can tell me that in the chats. We came across your interview, Tim, there's no secret plan interview, right? And there certainly was a lot of media paid attention to this Rams, potential relocation before it actually happened. Now, not necessarily for Kenny Strode, but do you think any type of the coverage from the media side had any impact on the team leaving, or was that just a decision that they had already decided to make independent of the fans and media's response to the potential for a move?
Yeah, that's a great question. No, I don't think it had anything to do with it. I actually talked with Kevin Demoff multiple times throughout this process. The final time we exchanged texts was from inside the room of the vote in January of 2016. And I recall saying to him, Dan, I said, you know, a lot of people in St. Louis feel like the moment Stan exercised his right of first refusal to buy the franchise from Shad Khan was the moment that you guys knew you were going to Los Angeles. And he said, well, that's not true. There's nothing I can do to change people's minds. But we knew, because of the lease, we were either going to get a world-class stadium in St. Louis, or we would have the opportunity to leave. And we couldn't get St. Louis to come to the table. Now, the people in St. Louis say that is absolutely false, and that Stan Kroenke was not willing to come to the table. That is not the story that Demoff tells. Demoff tells me that their hope was essentially parallel to what happened in Indianapolis. They drafted Peyton Manning, and the Colts experienced a resurgence, and they eventually wound up with Lucas Oil Field. Their hope was with Sam Bradford, which I realize kind of sounds like a joke now, but with Sam Bradford, St. Louis would experience a resurgence like the Colts did in Indianapolis and build St. Louis's version of Lucas Oil Stadium. Many St. Louisans, I'm sure, are rolling their eyes at that because in their minds, they thought that Kroenke knew he was moving to LA the moment he could.
Yeah, I certainly think, that's the whole point of this lawsuit, right? And I know we had Ben Fredrickson on our podcast who mentioned that back in 2010, that Stan Kroenke registered the Rams as a Los Angeles-based company, right? There's the comments from Jeff Fisher back in 2012 that they were talking to him about potentially relocating a team, and that was on the table. So, you know, as much as, I don't really think the fan response had anything to do with it. And you mentioned, Tim, Sam Bradford, right? I think this was maybe a combination of you, maybe Ben Fredrickson, a bunch of different hosts had made this point, but, you know, maybe it was in the Rams' interest to lose games during that period to kind of turn back and say, hey, fan support isn't as great as it could be elsewhere, right? And if you had a team that was humming like the Kurt Warner Rams, maybe you can't really make that argument. What do you guys think to that, Tim and Jody?
Well, I think that is something that I wasn't thinking while it was going on, but a few months after the Rams had relocated to Los Angeles, Kevin Demoff went back to his alma mater, Westlake, and spoke and was essentially talking about, you know, the football equivalent to the baptism scene in The Godfather and revealing how they pulled off the hit. And the Rams in 2015, to everyone's surprise, were decent, not great. And they were actually in the mix for a playoff spot at the start of November of 2015. And Demoff said, his own words, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, we went on a losing streak, which then allowed us to begin focusing on the process of relocating. And, you know, you actually have the COO of a franchise on the record. I mean, again, this is stuff that I know the rest of the country either doesn't care about or doesn't know about, but it really did happen. This isn't stuff I'm just pulling out of nowhere. Again, I went out there to track it down. So this isn't just grabbing stuff on Twitter to get likes. He said this. Can you imagine, take your pick of whatever general manager of whatever North American professional sports team saying, fortunately or unfortunately, we went on a losing streak. But he did say that. They knew they were moving. And anybody close in the NFL knew what was going to happen. I'd still love to know, and I know it's irrelevant to the legal element, but the one part of this that I can't figure out is why the committee on relocating to LA recommended Carson 5-1 and then the vote flipped. I mean, I know why the vote flipped. I just want to know why they recommended it 5-1. Not that that necessarily has anything to do with legal issues. It just speaks to this whole movement has slithered for a decade And it's just lovely that the rest of the country is finally getting aware of what went on here. St. Louis is not Los Angeles. Nobody would argue that case. But St. Louis sports fans are incredibly passionate, incredibly loyal. And Stan Kroenke painted the city and the region and its people completely unfairly so he could go and make more money. And that's business. Yeah. That's fine. But again, should there be penalties for that? Because St. Louis did put a stadium on the table. You guys can speak to that better than I can. I can only speak for what I know happened. And what happened has not been told up until recently. And still, name your NFL reporter. Most of them still haven't written about it or talked about it. It is the topic that he or she shall not speak of, or else you will lose your sourcing. It's a magical little game. Everybody knows how it's being played, and that's why it's not getting talked about. The Gruden emails are titillating, so we all talk about it, and the NFL leaked it, so now we can talk about it. But this story, which could put Jerry Jones and Roger Goodell and Kevin Demoff and Stan Kroenke walking through the streets of downtown St. Louis with their attorneys in January, nobody's talking about it outside of you two guys and Mike Florio and up until this morning, Andrew Brandt. And that's a media miracle to me.
Yeah. Well, no, it's going to multiply, Tim. As we get closer to trial, you're going to see all those news and media trucks outside the courthouse beginning on January 10th. You can count on that. And before I turn back to Jody, the answer to your question as to why did they vote, you know, for one plan and not the other? These are answers that are going to be elicited during the trial, because this is going to be an 8-week trial. And if the NFL does not settle this with the city of St. Louis, all of this becomes fair game. And this is part of direct examination, cross-examination. We haven't even gotten to the witness list yet. That's going to be due at the end of the month. Expect to see a witness list of epic proportions covering all the people who are in the committee meetings, the owners. You're going to be able to kind of hear directly from the horse's mouth under oath what some of the thinking was if this does not settle. So, Jody, we've been litigating relocation disputes going back 40 years. I mean, yes, I was like, I think 18 years old in college when the first Raiders case was going on. I guess I gave away my age a little bit. And despite these initial criteria, the amended criteria, every time there's a move, litigation, follows. The city of Oakland is a plaintiff. City of St. Louis is a plaintiff. When does this ever end? I know you talk about the city, you talk about the NFL being scared of precedent. But regardless of where the appellate rulings lie and what the jury verdict lies, the next time this happens, there will be litigation again. And this is a state law issue. What happens in Missouri doesn't bind what happens in Buffalo. It doesn't bind what happens to Minnesota. In Minnesota, each state is part of a different federal circuit court. So what's the next step for the future of these relocation guidelines? This can't just go on interminably without there being a severe cost inflicted upon the NFL.
So you're absolutely right about the litigation response to team relocations, right? From the NFL's perspective, you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. There will be a lawsuit, whether you block a move or whether you permit it, there will be a lawsuit. And just to give you a sense of the power in particular of antitrust lawsuits, which are federal lawsuits, which address questions of federal law as opposed to state law. Here is my demonstration of the power of antitrust. You actually asked me if I had some slides to show because I teach this in my class. I do. I'm not sure if you want me to share it now. I can just recite it. But here's the power of antitrust. Three major sports leagues do not have antitrust immunity: the NFL, the NBA, and the NHL. Major League Baseball has antitrust immunity. What has happened since the 1982 Raiders litigation and a finding of liability for the first time, a professional sports league was found liable for trying to block a team relocation, liable under the antitrust laws, which are quite punitive. They have built into them treble damages, right? So what has happened since then? So, if I were to share my slides, you will see that there were 9 franchise relocations in the NFL in the post-Raiders era. The Colts left in the middle of the night in 1984 to Indianapolis. The St. Louis Cardinals, St. Louis, moved to Arizona in 1988. The Cleveland Browns left town and became the Baltimore Ravens in 1996. The league had gotten a little smarter by then and were able to negotiate to retain the team's name for Cleveland. Then you had the Houston Oilers leaving for Tennessee in 1998. The league again did the same, didn't retain the name, but retained a place for a franchise in Houston. Then next came the Rams moving to St. Louis and finally back again to LA, the Chargers moving to LA, and the Raiders, which moved to LA in 95 and then back to, and then out to, back to Oakland. Back to Vegas in 2020. The point is there were 9 team relocations. Why? Because as I said, damned if you do, damned if you don't. Each one of these teams and their destination cities would have filed an antitrust lawsuit against the league if the league tried to block the move, following in the path of Los Angeles, Memorial Coliseum, and the then Oakland Raiders in suing the league in 1982. And what happened in the other leagues? In the NBA, there was litigation back in 1984 over the San Diego Clippers move to LA, which set the stage with that relocation was permitted, which set the stage for a total of 7 NBA franchise relocations between 1984 and 2008. The NHL had 6 franchise relocations between 1982 and 2011. That is a total of 22 franchise relocations across the 3 major leagues that are subject to the antitrust laws. How many were there in Major League Baseball? Tim, how many?
The Expos. That's the only one that's. I know the Rays are talking about it.
That's it. Why? That is the power of antitrust. And here's the problem. It has skewed the power dynamics between home cities, destination cities, leagues, member clubs. What can be done to right this? I will suggest that there are things that cities should be doing that they're not doing. One example is, maybe it's more a state issue, is what happened in Ohio. In the wake of Art Modell moving the Cleveland Browns to Baltimore, they passed a law which requires a professional sports team that plays most of its home games in a tax-supported stadium and that receives financial assistance from state and local government to refrain from any attempt to move to a new location without either A, the consent of the hometown, or B, 6 months advance notice and an opportunity for locals to purchase the team. And they challenged a move quite recently. I don't know if you follow Major League Soccer, but Ohio challenged the attempt to move the Columbus Crew to Texas, to Austin, Texas. And the strength of this legislation empowered the local community in negotiations with Major League Soccer, who kept the team there and solved their issue of an unhappy owner by giving him a brand new franchise in Austin, Texas. Right? There is something really wrong with the power dynamics here, caused by antitrust, caused by Maverick owners. Every one of those NFL relocations would have been stopped or at least given far more deference to the hometown, to the losing city, if the NFL wasn't afraid of an antitrust lawsuit.
Okay, Jody, you have to leave at 12 at 1:15. Is this the appointed hour? Because you want to stick around?
I do have 5 more minutes because okay. I am interested in hearing what others have to say on this.
Yeah, we've got 195 participants. We kind of retained so much of our original audience. Dan, you want to take it from here?
So as a quick programming note, we did not expect this many questions. I think we expected this many attendees. It's been a lot of engagement online. I didn't expect this many questions. So what I think we're going to do as a programming note, Jody has to pop off in 5 minutes. We're going to hang the remaining me, Tim, and Dan Wallach. We're going to try to go through all of these questions. But Jody, to your point, and I'm going to spare you the chat because I'm being inundated with St. Louis fans that are not happy that you used to work for the NFL, which is fine. It's not your fault. I think secretly we all would like to work for the NFL at some point, but Jody has no connection to the NFL. And is just, I think we have to take this. And again, Dan and I are not from St. Louis. Jody doesn't work for the NFL. Tim is from St. Louis, but that's why we have Tim on here. We need to have the voice of the people. And especially because this case is being tried in front of a St. Louis jury. So that understanding the case is important. Now, as much as I think probably 90% of the people that are listening to this are Rams fans or scorned Rams fans in some sense, you have to acknowledge, right, The NFL has some very high-powered lawyers behind them. They're not just coming up with this argument out of thin air, and they're paying a lot of, hold on, let's see. But they're making these arguments in court, so we just want to advance them on both sides. Yeah. So you could be right, you could be wrong, but we gotta play it out here. That's the whole point of this. You're not going to learn anything by hearing one point of view.
Listen, the city of St. Louis is represented by some of the best trial lawyers in the city of St. Louis. So I always hear that, they've got the best lawyers and really smart lawyers on one side. These are competing arguments being advanced by some of the best lawyers, some of the best legal minds. Bob Blitz has a reputation in St. Louis as one of the top trial lawyers, in the city. This is one of the reasons why the NFL is seeking his disqualification. So as we, shift from our sort of four-member panel format, I think we could sort of take some questions. I don't know if Tim wants to, if he can stick around or Jody can stick around, but we're up for it.
I would just chime in and say, I am totally sympathetic to the St. Louis fans. Yeah. As I am to anybody who has given their heart and soul rooting for the local team, which I do for my local teams. And you will have sympathy for me when you hear that my local team is the New York Giants. But in any event, the statements I've made here today are not because I have an interest in any way in this litigation. I'm just trying to provide some legal and historical context here for why we are stuck with the power dynamic that we have today, and maybe make some suggestions on how we can fix it so cities are not put in the position that St. Louis has been put in.
Well, it's going to be federal legislation, but of course the NFL has all the top lobbyists in DC, and there've been multiple attempts over the years to provide some greater protection for cities. I think back in 1985, you had the Professional Sports Community Protection Act, which actually mandated, I don't know if you teach this in your class, but it mandated that any city relocation would have to, or any team relocation from one city to the other would have to satisfy the threshold of being necessary. And that determination would be made by an arbitration board, meaning the National Football League couldn't approve a relocation unless an independent arbitrator said that it was okay. And then cities would be able to challenge it. Pete Rozelle, during his testimony before Congress in 1985, said, if you're going to have a judicial remedy, and he was acquiescing in a sense to a judicial remedy for cities, he said on three conditions, can't be in home cities, and there can't be any punitive damages. And out of those hearings, the NFL's relocation guidelines sprung, and they were identical guidelines and criteria to what was being considered before the Senate and Congress back in 1985. So I basically ask one fundamental question: what's the point of having these guidelines and criteria if the entity is not going to abide by them or properly consider them? And who's the body that makes that determination as to whether they were abided by or properly considered? The one making the decision, of course, they're going to land on the side of, well, we properly considered it. How can you check that? How can you challenge that without a judicial remedy? And antitrust, I don't think, is the remedy for challenging whether the NFL properly considered criteria A, C, D, or E. There has to be some kind of remedy in order to give aggrieved cities an opportunity to say the league didn't even follow its own rules here. It can't just be antitrust. And that's why I believe that the history of the negotiations between the cities, the Conference of Mayors, and the National Football League, and how these criteria emerged from the sort of the birth of these joint statement of principles, how that could play a relevant role at the trial. And I think a jury should hear all of these factors and all of these facts and circumstances that led to the creation of the guidelines. It's ultimate jury question.
Just being mindful of time, I want to make sure Jody gets out. And Jody, just as a credit to you, after you said that comment, the chat, which only I can see, you have to take my word for it, said that we love Jody's opinion, we love that she came, and we love that she explained to us. So, listen.
I'm happy for all the feedback that I get, negative and positive. I appreciate it all. And
you may have to go private on Twitter for a couple of days.
No, you're good. You have a nice audience.
And right. Thank you for both of you for hosting this. This is a real service, and I'm glad I had the opportunity to join you today.
Of course, Jody. Thanks so much for joining us. Okay. All right, Dan, you want to just open it up?
Yeah. So I'm trying to multitask here. They got the glare trying to kill me on top of me, and I'm trying to get all the chat. I'm trying to protect Jody over here. Okay. So the main, I got this from three different people, and Tim, I'm going to ask it to you, and we can just talk as if this was a podcast. I don't know what the podcast recording is going to sound like, but it's fine. Tim, you said it. Listen, we're kind of slaves to the beat, right? At a certain point, the John Gruden stuff, people keep asking this particular question, right? There are 650,000 emails. Dan, I don't know if we know the answer to this. You and I haven't talked about it. You would imagine during the course of discovery that what was asked of the NFL is any and all emails that reference the St. Louis Rams, that reference St. Louis, that use any of those words. And that would have been on the Washington server. It would have been anywhere. So of those 650,000 emails that were, in Washington's possession, I imagine some of them would have something to do with this period of time and this particular issue. I know Ben Fredrickson mentioned it on our podcast, right? Someone like Jerry Richardson with the Carolina Panthers was at a period of time talking to people about this particular relocation. I'm sure if you looked at Jerry Jones' emails, it's going to pop up. Tim, how do you think, and Dan, I can ask you, let's pretend I'm just moderating for everybody. How do you think this factors in here, right? Is this something that could slow the trial? Is this something that they would have had access to? I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, the Jerry Richardson thing's interesting because he is on the record in the discovery of saying he felt like the NFL was going against its own relocation guidelines. So he is talking about the guidelines that most of this town hall has been centered on. And yes, Jerry Jones was the guy who pushed Stan Kroenke across the goal line. So I would imagine that would certainly be there on the Cowboys server with regard to the Washington football team server. I don't know. I don't know how interested Dan Snyder was. There were some owners, Richardson, McNair, the late Bob McNair, who were in, I don't know if they were in St. Louis's corner or they were in Dean Spanos's corner, and therefore the enemy of my enemy is my friend. I don't know how it broke down. I just knew that that's where they were. And then I know that kind of the new money, so to speak, NFL owners were in Kroenke's camp. And Jerry Jones gave his fire and brimstone speech when they closed the doors in Houston. And magically the vote overturned from Carson to Inglewood. But my reason for bringing that up, guys, is I don't know did Dan Snyder really care all that much about it. You know, did take your pick of whomever else was an owner who wasn't really involved in that part really care that much that they would be emailing? I don't know. Jerry Jones, absolutely. Yes. And obviously Spanos and Davis, absolutely. But I don't know. I don't know on Snyder, but of the 650,000, I'm sure that the word St. Louis had to be in there.
So quick question. We have two. I want to answer one. And Drew has a really good question. Actually, let's go straight to Drew's question. Somebody asked, what's the difference between the Oakland Raiders lawsuit and this lawsuit? The Oakland Raiders lawsuit is based in antitrust. So the reason that was dismissed and now it's up on appeal is because of antitrust grounds. They haven't answered this contractual question. So that's the difference. I think for a year, people weren't paying attention. And Dan and I weren't looking at this case. And we said, oh, yeah, the Raiders case got kicked. This case will get kicked, too. And then when we looked at it really closely, this has no antitrust component. So that's right. The difference. It's the easiest way to explain it. Okay, now Drew asked a great question, and we should spend some time on this. Dan Wallach, I'll give this to you, right? You're the lawyer in this panel. Drew asks, when it comes to the settlement discussion, what is the reasoning behind the expansion team concept? If Kroenke truly indemnified the NFL and the 31 other owners, what obligation does the NFL have to participate in that settlement in any way? Dan, I'll give it to you.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I don't know the terms of the indemnification agreement. What is it? Legal fees?
Right.
Is it damages? Listen. Obviously, the number here, following a jury trial, when you consider the different categories of damages, the increase in the franchise value, the disgorgement of the relocation fee, lost income, lost revenue, out of pocket expenses, it could wipe Stan Kroenke's net worth out. I mean, he's worth $12 billion. When you tack on punitive damages, there's going to be, as Tim mentioned, a wide delta, but on the upper end of the most optimistic recovery for the city of St. Louis, it's not inconceivable that a jury would return a verdict of at least $5 billion to the city of St. Louis, comprised of the $1 to $2 billion increase in franchise value, $500 million of the relocation fee, the lost taxes, lost, you know, tourism, all the economic benefit associated with having an NFL team, the devaluation of the dome, all the individual income categories that arise from having a team. those numbers in a worst case scenario for the NFL, and then when you add punitive damages, there are billions of reasons why Stan Kroenke doesn't want to write that check. And the reason why the team or the expansion team becomes a conversation starter is because the league and the city see the lawsuit from opposite ends of the economic spectrum. The NFL thinks that on appeal, the Missouri Court of Appeals will throw out the breach of contract and unjust enrichment claims because the relocation policy is not a contract granting third-party beneficiary rights to cities. And that even if there was such a right, the measure of damages should be limited to the lost income, not the disgorgement of the fee and the increased valuation. There's this notion in the law that damages for a breach of contract should put the plaintiff back in the position it would have been had the breach not occurred. And had the breach not occurred, there wouldn't have been this windfall of $550 million being visited upon the city of St. Louis. There wouldn't have been any transfer to Los Angeles. There wouldn't have been any increase in valuation. And that's sort of that's the risk that the city is taking by going to trial. But be that as it may, the city has all of its claims intact, has all of its damage theories intact, and it's going to trial in a position where it could recover under each one of those claims and each one of those damage theories. So from the city's vantage point, it's $1 billion plus case. From the NFL's vantage point, it's a $100 million damages case. And that gap provides some room. You can't split the difference. You can't find a middle ground on the money so easily. And one of the non-monetary factors that can come into play is a franchise. I mean, the NFL is not going to want to write a check for, you know, $1 billion plus. Kroenke doesn't want to write that check. They're going to expand anyway over time. This is not etched in stone that the NFL has to be 32 teams in perpetuity. There's going to be a future expansion. And the city of St. Louis is a large enough market to be one of the top. They're one of the top 32 markets in any event. But as the NFL expands, it's not out of the realm that St. Louis would be a site for a future NFL franchise. And if it gets the league and Kroenke off the hook for a $1 billion plus damages verdict, I don't see any reason why they wouldn't do it. And in fact, that logic has filtered into the boardroom of the National Football League, because Florio is reporting that these conversations are in fact taking place from very, very, you know, good sources of his. So he hasn't made that part up. It's a difficult case to settle because they see it from two different economic universes, and the franchise is the one way to bridge the gap.
So Dan, I have a question for you that Matt Eddy asked. Actually, I don't know the answer to this, and obviously you will when I asked it. Dan, are you ready? You're on the hot seat.
Yeah.
We should do a podcast with more live questions. This is great. I have all the power here. I can ask you all the
questions. Oh, yeah, we have a talk show on, Tim, do you have some juice at your
station? You make some magic here, gentlemen.
You own it. Don't you own it?
I own the content of my show. Yes, I do. The podcast and the radio show.
That was Dan's attempt to get off the hot seat. Dan, I told you.
That was a nice redirect. I know that. I was wise.
And Dan, before you turn to the question,
you're trying to get off it. Okay, go ahead.
I want to correct something about the Oakland Raiders lawsuit. There is similarity between Oakland and St. Louis. The federal antitrust claims are pending in federal court, have been dismissed, and the Ninth Circuit is potentially going to reverse that. But there is the unjust enrichment and breach of contract claims that were litigated in Los Angeles County Superior Court. Once the federal claims were dismissed, there was no independent basis for supplemental jurisdiction over the, you know, state law contract claim. So the city of Oakland brought that in state court, and a Los Angeles Superior Court dismissed it on a motion to dismiss in April of 2021, roughly 6 months ago, agreeing with Jody Balsam's position. And that is
why,
now.
Why do you smile when you say that?
Because I know I'm right. I know ultimately I'm right here. Listen, I didn't work for anybody
for 5 minutes to get off the hot seat. It's not a bad question. Yeah. Don't worry. Yeah. I was just tricking you. It's not that bad of a question. Matt Eddy asked.
Go ahead.
Matt Eddy asked, did the Association of Mayors statement of principles with the NFL come out in discovery in the Rams lawsuit, or did Dan W. find this independently? This can be a powerful piece of evidence if introduced to trial and can make the third party beneficiary claim a jury question. Dan, I don't know the answer to that. Did you find that independently, or was that part of the disclosures? Because I thought the record was sealed for the disclosures.
No, I found it. I am the Indiana Jones of sports law.
If I was it's out say.
There, if it's out there on the internet, I'm going to find it. And I was getting around to this. I found this one issue vexing. I've heard so many voices that don't know what they're talking about saying that the NFL made this policy. It can change the policy at any time. It's an internal policy. Therefore, it's not the contract. It's intended to benefit the interests of the quote unquote league and its home market. And I'm calling BS on that, that there's got to be more to the story. And I just, you know, from my perch here in Siberia, Not a joke.
He's in Siberia, but go ahead.
I did a lot of research, and I came across a congressional record from 1999 when the U.S. Congress was contemplating a federal bill which would give the NFL antitrust protections around franchise movement. And I found the congressional record, and within the congressional record, there was correspondence between the NFL and the U.S. Conference of the Mayors, and as our questioner correctly pointed out, I tweeted about it, and he makes a very strong point that did this come out in discovery? I don't think we know whether it came out in discovery, but I would expect that really good commercial litigators would have found it one way or the other, because they are exhibits in the Oakland Raiders case, that's for sure. I learned that after the fact, and this is such obvious discovery material that I would have imagined that the city of St. Louis's attorneys would have requested documents in a broad enough way that would have encompassed these types of materials, which were correspondence and letters between the NFL and other municipalities. It would have been just a colossal oversight by the city to not have requested it. And I doubt the National Football League would have withheld producing those kinds of documents that are already in the public domain. So I can't answer the question as to whether the city knew about it, whether the NFL knew about it, whether it's part of the tens of thousands of documents that comprise the discovery materials. But I do believe it is a significant asset, or it will provide a significant boost to the city's claim that it's an intended beneficiary of the NFL's relocation policy. I mean, look at it this way. The joint statement of principles is a contract, a jointly executed document between the league and the city of and the Conference of Mayors, which created the amended relocation criteria. That originated in the joint statement of principles. Paul Tagliabue admitted before Congress that those joint statement of principles document, which include the criteria that are now part of the guidelines, that document was incorporated by reference into the amended relocation policy. It creates factual question upon contractual question about the party's intent, and it is unassailable evidence of the intent of the NFL to enact an amended policy that would protect and balance the interests of not only the league, but the cities. And if there's any other intended beneficiary besides the league and its member teams, it has to be the cities. They negotiated that document. They negotiated it over many months. It's a co-produced joint document, and it was incorporated by reference into the NFL amended relocation criteria, one after the other. And you have Paul Tagliabue's testimony and the words of Joe Brown in that letter from June 1999, openly and expressly admitting that these relocation guidelines were intended to benefit the cities. My God, how much more do you need? I mean, if this was a law school question, no, it shouldn't even be a bona fide question. At best, it's an automatic third-party beneficiary status. At worst, it creates issues of fact for the jury to sift through to make a determination as to what the parties intended here.
So, Dan, I have some good news. You ready for this? You're so scared that I'm going to ask you something bad. This is good news. We have a reporter that's in the Zoom, and he has a question for you. He's writing a story. And Dan, the reason it's good news, Dan and I do our podcast, and Dan always says he wants to speak in a way that's very quotable, just in case anyone picks it up. But now I'm handing it to you on a silver platter, right? Here's the question from a reporter.
Well, depends who the reporter is, right?
Holden Kerwicki, he said he's worked.
That's with a good one. Okay, that is going to be a good question.
ASDK. You don't know if the question is going to be a good question. I'm just telling you it's a question.
He's a plant. I paid him to ask the question.
Here's the question. From a legal standpoint, what is it about the St. Louis lawsuit that gives it the teeth where similar lawsuits have fizzled out in the past?
Well, there haven't been that many similar lawsuits that have fizzled out in the past. I mean, of recent vintage, you have the Oakland Raiders case that's, you know, on appeal. And then in the 90s, you had a few cases. What gives this the sizzle, I think, is the fact that it's all about the venue. The city of St. Louis's attorneys made a tactical decision to not go the federal antitrust route and to have this case litigated exclusively in state court. And that was the most important decision that the city made, because if they were in federal court, they would have been bogged down on antitrust issues. And this notion of third party beneficiary, the relocation guidelines being a contract, that would have been subordinated to the antitrust principles, and it never would have gotten the airing that it received in a St. Louis state court. And the St. Louis state court system does have a reputation of being a very pro plaintiffs forum. And Bob Blitz and the others said, you know, that they probably made a tactical decision that their best chance of holding the NFL accountable would be to bring suit in St. Louis and focus exclusively on state law claims around the relocation policy and around the fraudulent misrepresentations. And that's the reason why they've made it all the way to the doorstep of trial. They may very well have met the fate of the Oakland Raiders case had this lawsuit been brought on antitrust grounds in a Missouri federal court, because being in state court has its advantages. And you wonder why wouldn't the NFL try to move this case into federal court? The fact is they would not, because there are only state law questions. There are no federal questions. And the only other basis under which to transfer a case to federal court is diversity of citizenship. And here you have the city of St. Louis on the one hand suing, I don't want to get into a whole diversity of citizenship discussion. I've gone off the rails a little bit, but the number one reason that this case has gone as far as it has was the decision to focus on state law claims and file suit in state court. And that's the difference between this lawsuit and all the other ones that have predated it, which played out in the federal court system.
So I guess this news is just for everyone, the 166 people here watching.
That's pretty good.
Some news. I found Brian Laundrie. He actually joined our Zoom very briefly, and then he left. So he was here. So I might have to tell the FBI after this that Brian Laundrie was actually in our chat. You guys both know who I'm talking about, okay?
Yeah, no, Dan, absolutely.
Tim knows him. Dan, you're in Russia, so this is beyond you at this point. Okay, Tim, this one is for you. There's a comment. I don't have the name of who asked it. I apologize, but it's more of a comment, but I wanted to ask you about it. I remember on Tim's show, they interviewed Terry Bradshaw. They asked about the Rams staying in St. Louis, and he kind of laughed and said, everyone associated with the NFL knows they are moving. I've been recently rewatching Entourage, just, you know, for whatever reason. And there's a hell of a whole episode that I completely forgot where Jerry Jones comes in and gives Ari, or wants to give Ari, the 33rd NFL franchise, and it's going to be in Los Angeles.
Yep.
So I completely forgot about that narrative.
I remember that.
Yeah, but there seemed to just be a world where, like, okay, obviously we're going to go to LA. It's
right.
Just a matter of how. When did the narrative switch from, which I don't really remember this, and maybe from 33rd franchise going to Los Angeles to let's move a current team to Los Angeles, or was that always on tap?
I think the only place where you heard about the 33rd franchise was with Vincent Chase. Nobody was talking about that. We knew that it was. I don't want to say we as if I'm speaking for all of St. Louis, but those of us paying attention closely to it, and with what we do for a living, it's our responsibility to do that, saw that this was live. And because of my conversations with people in the know, I was aware that this was a real situation. So help me, a week before the vote in Houston, the NFL met in New York. You'll be able to track this down. It wasn't a secret meeting or anything like that. And I got off the phone with a source, and I turned to my wife and I said, well, that's it. It's the Rams are moving, and it's going to be the Rams and the Chargers. Now, keep in mind, by the way, if you recall what Andrew Brandt said earlier on in the town hall discussion, it was the Raiders and Chargers who were the teammates. The Rams were on their own in Inglewood. The Raiders and Chargers were working to turn the landfill into a stadium in Carson. Yet I was aware a week out that it was going to be the Rams and the Chargers. Why? Because Kroenke could afford to build the stadium, and the old school guys felt bad for Spanos that he was going to be left behind in San Diego, and so they let him be his tenant unless they could figure it out in San Diego. Because keep in mind, the Chargers didn't move for a year. They had a vote. It didn't come close to passing in San Diego, and the Chargers then moved. And speaking of 33 teams, so this is the thing, and that's why the question I wanted to ask you guys, which I'm sure a lot of the people who are watching this want to know what your opinion of the actual result will be. I feel like the perfect fit, and I'm lacking the economic knowledge on the San Diego Chargers relationship with the Los Angeles Rams, the Los Angeles Chargers. I don't know if you guys are aware of an article in the Los Angeles Times in April of this year in which Dean Spanos and his siblings are fighting it out over the situation with the Chargers. And
very
so
familiar. We covered it on the podcast.
Okay, you did. Okay, great. So that's not something that I think most of the people who are in our audience were aware of, and that Spanos said, okay, I'm going to put the team up for sale after the 2024 season. To me, a solution that would probably make Kroenke happy, not that necessarily people in St. Louis are interested in that, but that could be the grand bargain, is whoever buys the Chargers from Spanos moves the Chargers here. Kroenke now owns LA all to himself, and St. Louis were to get the Chargers, so the NFL is not cutting up its pieces in 33rds, or if they had to add another team, 34ths, and so you continue to have the round number of 32, because it's not like the Chargers are gaining real traction or ever really had any traction in Los Angeles, and as people who are familiar with the Southern California makeup, it's not like the people of San Diego are like, oh, good, they're in LA, it's close, we'll go support them. That's not the way the San Diego-Los Angeles relationship works. So again, I don't know if that's even possible, but it's something that to me would actually make more sense than an expansion team, because now you're cutting up the pie with a 33rd, and 33, of course, is not a round number. So if you want to get to a round number, now you're going to add another team. So you're cutting up the pie with two teams.
Yeah, Tim, as a New York Giants fan, I wholeheartedly endorse the idea of bringing San Diego to my home market. We all want to have Justin Herbert as our starting quarterback. Yeah,
that's a football biased take.
Yeah, so, you know, if it was Sam Bradford as the quarterback, I think you'd rather have the expansion team. It's everybody wants that franchise, and it's tailor-made. And I've mulled over the notion of the St. Louis Chargers. It makes a lot of sense for the reasons you've outlined, and I think St. Louis would deserve to have a franchise quarterback.
But the question I wanted to get your guys' opinion, I know, I mean, I've been listening to your podcast, and Daniel, you were on our show a few weeks ago. I know here in St. Louis, with talking to people in the legal community, doesn't mean they're in the know, you know, so I don't want to represent that I've got people inside the room. That would be disingenuous. It's not true. I think you have a lot of people right now acting like they know what's going on, when in reality, they might not really know. And as you guys know, as attorneys, the reasons are clear. With that said, with knowing what you guys know about the law, and then also about this case, what do you think the outcome is going to be? Because I don't think this thing's ever going to get to trial. But I love the fact that you guys think it's going to go to trial, because that's certainly what I would like to see.
Can I say something, Dan? Because you're going to give more of the in the weeds. So let me give the big picture version. There's two rabbit holes to go down very quickly. If the jury is a St. Louis jury and the judge is a St. Louis judge, as we've seen, I mean, it's being funneled, right? So there's two questions. If it will go to trial, if it goes to trial, what will happen? If you put this case in front of a St. Louis jury, I don't see how you can have really a true unbiased jury in St. Louis. Obviously they've done this in different jurisdictions, different municipalities. They've had, you know, where a plaintiff is a municipality and the jury is, you know, residents of that municipality. I don't really think it's that fair. If you can move the case to an adjacent county, I don't really see the big deal of it. But at the end of the day, St. Louis has the closest nexus to the case, so I do understand from that perspective. Now, why do we think it could go to trial? Again, just full disclosure here, 99.999% of cases settle, right? That's the gist of it. You have a party here of the NFL that isn't really afraid. You know, they have enough money. They don't seem to be afraid to settle this. They don't seem to be afraid to fight people in court over big issues like this with the USFL. And obviously now with the Oakland Raiders, they're fighting that. So they have a track record of, they don't want to stand down to these particular big markets. They don't want to set a bad precedent of settling and saying they're doing anything wrong. So I guess at a final point, then I'll give it to you, Dan. Yeah. There's always a cost benefit analysis. So I have plenty of cases that are, let's say, $100,000 cases, right? And at a certain point, does the plaintiff want to spend $25,000, $30,000, $45,000, $50,000 for a chance to go to a jury and get $100,000? No, right? That's why most cases settle. They settle because the economics don't make sense. You have to pay experts for $25,000, $30,000. Doesn't make sense. Here, there is no that finish line of like, okay, we're getting our cost, are almost getting close to our reward. We're nowhere close to that because in no world are you expanding or expending $1 billion in costs, right? If anything, you're maybe in the millions. I don't even think, you know, maybe in the single, you know, seven digits, eight digits, don't get there. So that analysis doesn't occur here. So yeah, I don't think from an economic standpoint, the settlement really makes sense unless St. Louis wants to take pennies on the dollar, which it doesn't seem like they want to. It seems like they want to go for the lottery ticket and go in front of a St. Louis jury, in which case, you know, they might get a number in the billions. We'll see if it stands up on appeal. But anyway, Dan, go ahead.
Well, what lottery ticket is that? I'd want to enter a lottery like that where I try a case in front of a St. Louis jury where the judge has already made pretrial rulings that suggest that his instructions to the jury will allow them to consider the increased value of the franchise from going to LA, the relocation fee. This is set up to be a humongous plaintiff's verdict. And I didn't say it's going to go to trial. I think the NFL would be crazy to take this to trial, because once you take it to a trial, this is already set up for a plaintiff's verdict. And I disagree with you that this is a biased jury. The bar for demonstrating actual bias to transfer the venue of a trial is so high. I did some research yesterday. There were 63 cases that I found. 62 of them were criminal matters. In the 63rd, it was a civil case. One, it was denied in that case. It's really intended to be for criminal cases, not civil cases. And the NFL made the very same argument in Oakland back in 1984. How can you have jurors in a case which is going to benefit the municipality?
Right, it's happened, of course.
Yeah. I mean, the NFL.
But Dan, there's a difference between like the legal standard for bias and like the, okay, St. Louis is clearly biased here. Maybe not enough to move the trial, but I don't know. But, I mean, you can make that argument, but it's home cooking, right? We keep saying.
It's home cooking. Was it home cooking for Oakland when they lost in state and federal court in Oakland? They didn't get home cooking.
The judge. That wasn't the jury, though.
Okay, but they're getting very favorable pretrial rulings from a St. Louis judge. Anyway, there are two reasons why the NFL is not going to take this case to trial. Two major, major risks. What do they have going on in January and February? Planning for the Super Bowl at SoFi Stadium with the possibility of having the conference championship games in SoFi Stadium. This is going to be an eight-week trial that's going to run for the balance of January, all of February. It's going to overshadow the Super Bowl and cast a sort of a large cloud over that game. That's number one. That's sort of the optics. The optics are less important than I think the money. And the number two reason here is once you take these issues to a jury and there's a jury verdict, the standard of review before the Missouri Court of Appeals on questions of fact, mixed questions of fact, mixed questions of law, they're a little bit more deferential to a jury than taking an appeal of a question of law pretrial. The NFL is going to be playing with a very dangerous game to try to appeal a jury verdict when the question of whether there was a contract will ultimately turn on whether the contract was ambiguous or unambiguous. And when there are latent ambiguities, such as whether there was an intent to benefit cities, and you take into account all these external documents and congressional testimony, the jury's determination will be given much more deference than a judge's determination of law. And I wouldn't want to be in a position of being a defendant on the wrong end of a multi-billion dollar verdict, challenging a jury verdict where there are mixed questions of fact or law before a Missouri appellate court that recognizes an unjust enrichment theory that might very well allow a disgorgement of the relocation fee and the increased value of the team. I took a closer look at Missouri law of unjust enrichment, and it allows a remedy of restitution and disgorgement, not based upon what the plaintiff lost, but based upon what the defendant gained, quote unquote, at the expense of the plaintiff. And that language in a number of Missouri appellate court opinions creates some risk for the NFL that a Missouri appellate court may very well allow this disgorgement remedy to go forward. And then when you get before a St. Louis jury on punitive damages, regardless of what the number is for actual damages, I think you've got some very strong tort claims that could allow or permit a jury to really sock the NFL with a very high punitive damages award. And even if you exclude the relocation fee and the increased value from the equation, just the lost revenue on a tortious interference theory and the expenditures on a fraudulent misrepresentation theory, you could take those smaller buckets of damages of $200 million or so on a tort claim and multiply it by a ratio of 10 and have a damage award of $2 billion without even considering the relocation fee or the increased franchise value. It's a very dangerous game the NFL is playing for those two reasons, to take it all the way to trial with the knowledge of what awaits them on a post-judgment appeal.
So so we're going to end the panel here. I want to thank all the people for coming out. I think we had at least over 200 at one point. So good news and bad news. Bad news, this panel is ending. Good news is that Tim is actually joining us on the second panel later tonight. We have plenty of questions, plenty of ammo. I'm going to be moderating that probably a little more heavily, but I have some topics which, Tim, you can prepare for in advance. You have the questions. I'm going to have an open-ended topic on Kevin Demoff, right, and Mr. Grubman. I think we need to hear from people of St. Louis. That's the whole panel is people from St. Louis, as well as Ben Albrighton, who's from Denver, but covering this very closely. I think we need to hear the lead-up to how we got here, and that's the whole element of frauds. So definitely stay tuned for that. If you've registered for the event, you're going to automatically get that invite. And again, if you can't make the second panel, we're going to put that in the podcast. Parting thoughts, Tim, you have anything to say before we run out?
No, I want to reemphasize how grateful I think people in St. Louis are to both of you for not just covering it, but from covering it. You know, as I said, there was an article and I can't recall what it was, and I posted a link to it and somebody said, well, that wasn't really favorable to St. Louis. And I go, well, that's not my responsibility, is to provide information. You know, this isn't take your pick of whatever cable news outlet in which I'm trying to talk to people into a bubble, because I think St. Louis does have some blood on its hands in this. And I'm a St. Louisan, but I don't think I have any credibility with people beyond St. Louis if I'm just framing things through the eyes of a cheerleader. That wouldn't be my ethical responsibility. But we are grateful that finally, and I think it's been you guys and Pro Football Talk with Mike Florio over the last month, and now a bunch of people are following your lead, talking about what it truly is, a huge story. So that's why I'm happy to appear on this town hall and join you again here in 8 hours, I guess, if my math is correct.
Tim, I know you have to go. Dan, you have to go. I'll kind of run this out in the 2 or 3 minutes that follow. But you're talking about that CNBC article, and there are a lot of other articles that that place the focus on the lease and sort of the first tier facility issue as what this case is about. And this case has nothing to do with that.
Right.
The expiration of the lease had one benefit for the St. Louis Rams. It gave them the opportunity to at least qualify for relocation under the guidelines, because if they were under an active lease, the relocation guidelines would have forbidden a relocation. So this case is not about the lease. It's not about the 1995 relocation agreement. It is only about the time period between 2010 and 2016 and whether the NFL properly adhered to its own relocation policy. So all those other articles, and many of the other articles, come from a vantage point where I don't think they understand the issues in the case. And right. If they read the complaint, right. If they read the motions, the orders, it's pretty apparent that there's a record here, appellate opinions, lower court opinions. This is a case about the application of the relocation criteria and whether the city of St. Louis has the right in court to enforce those criteria. So they got it wrong. Dan and I have it right. And I think as we
move on. They're not lawyers. They're carrying water for the league and they're sports reporters. That's why I'm staying out of the legal element, because I know my place. They're carrying water for the league. You don't want to bite the hand that feeds you, which is why you haven't seen take your pick of whatever NFL reporters covering this story. I get it. I'm not angry about it, but I am grateful when people with credibility start discussing it, because it's a huge story that has not gotten any attention outside of St. Louis up until about a month ago, which is crazy, but that's the truth.
Yeah. I mean, and when Dan says that we got it right and everyone got it wrong, listen, that's an example of us being a little bit biased, maybe not like legally biased, but like pretty biased. Dan, we got to go.
No, this is my panel. This is my panel, buddy.
I might just go this way.
Last closing thought, we've come a long way in 1 month. A month ago, nobody was talking about this case. And today you have the prospect of settlement negotiations or the prospect of an NFL team. Nobody was talking about this a month ago. We're talking about it now. And I think this is night and day, and this is a really positive development. So I think one way or the other, the city is going to end up in a really good place, either with a favorable settlement monetarily or a new team. And I think it's going to be a new team.
I think a lot of people in St. Louis love hearing you say that. That's all I'll say. I'm done. I got to get ready for another one here in 8 hours.
I got one too. Later, boys. We'll see everybody tonight at, Dan, what time? 9 p.m. CT. We'll be here. Thanks, That's guys. Right,
thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Dan. Thanks, Tim. Thanks, everybody.
That was 2 hours of unfiltered fun. Just as a programming note, Dan got a little mad at me at the end, as you could tell from the recording. What happened, just a little bit behind baseball, we're all about transparency here. I told Dan that I had a hard out at 1:50. I did not think the panel was going to go close to 2 hours. So we started at 12 Eastern time, and the panel gets to about 1 o'clock. Okay, Andrew Brandt needs to leave. Not that big of a deal. It's just three of us. Jody, she messages me during the chat. She needs to leave at 1:15. I'm like, okay. I guess we're going to wrap soon. It's just going to be me, Dan, and Tim. But what happened is we had so many people in the chat that kept asking questions. We had these numbers, and we had about 175 people. So Dan messaged me and goes, let's just keep going with Tim. So I said, sounds good. But I have a hard out at 1:50. So Dan said, not a problem. Not a problem, hard out at 1:50. Remember that. So we get to about 1:45, and of all people, Tim messages me. I have a hard out at 1:50. So I messaged Dan. Tim's got to go at 1:50. So Dan, God bless him, is so into this topic. He's so into the weeds, so much so that he forgot about the time. I had a hard out at a phone call too. Listen, I had a busy day of radio, some television. I got to do some, you know, I got to make moving and shaking. You know, 1:53 rolls around, and I go to Tim. I'm like, I'm going to give it to you. I'm chatting him behind baseball here. And I go, Tim, just give us your parting thoughts, and then I'll kind of wrap the panel. I'll tell Dan you got to go. And so, okay. So Tim goes, essentially, as you heard, right? You heard his final thoughts. Tim essentially said, blah, 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 blah. You know, there were some articles that said something wrong and blah, 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 blah. Thank you so much for covering the panel. And I'm already, I have the words ready to go. Tim, thanks so much. Let's call it a day. Shabbat shalom, whatever. Greetings, adios. You know, aloha. Aloha means goodbye. And then Dan starts talking about that CNBC article, which was a great point. It's totally fair to Dan, but we got to worry about the time situation here. So that's when Dan was saying, I have the last word. And then we were chatting, and you know, Dan and I, you know, we broke bread, we made up, but he couldn't understand why I wanted to leave. But I'm like, I got a radio interview too, got a GPFO here. But anyway, enough is that. Panel was fantastic. Dan, as only Dan can do, got into the weeds so beautifully. And, you know, this is the perfect story for Dan on a minutia level. Like, Dan is an appellate lawyer, but he loves these complex multi-party litigation. And that's made for Dan. So I think Dan did a fantastic job. I know Dan loved the way they came out. He loved the turnout. I don't know, Mike, I've been talking for a while. What did you think of that first panel?
I thought it was incredible. I mean, I didn't even realize how long time, like how much time had gone by the time we got to 2 hours. I was like, wow, it really felt pretty quick. I mean, when Andrew left, even at that point, I didn't even realize, I think we were already an hour in. It really shows how intricate this case is and how much coverage there can be on it. I mean, this is obviously, we've done three podcasts on it now, and now we had two panels dedicated to the St. Louis Rams relocation and the lawsuit and everything that's building up to it. So I think Dan took the reins and ran with this absolutely and did a really, really excellent job. And I think the amount of people that we had in there, I think at one point we had consistently like 230 people in here chatting, questions, you name it. People are interested in this. So I think it was a really great turnout and a great response. And I'm excited. Again, I'm excited that we made this happen.
Let us take this time to remind everyone that this podcast and all future podcasts until future notice is sponsored by Themis Bar Review. Listen, people of St. Louis, talk about Themis. They are ecstatic with the with our coverage of this lawsuit because they're a bar prep company. And it's not necessarily an ad read. I'm just being honest here. Those guys cover all areas of law with respect to bar preparation. So for them, we're hitting on appellate law. We're hitting on contract law. We're hitting on antitrust law. So our whole platform here is truthfully to teach people about the law through sports. I'm a lawyer. I went to law school, but I'm really a sports fan. And that's how I've always interpreted what we do here. I'm just talking to sports fans. I just happen to be teaching about law, just like my class, right? I want people to dissect the material as sports fans. They just happen to be law students. Same way we're teaching this podcast. So for Themis's purposes, all of our listeners are becoming a little bit smarter, right? They might be going that much more inclined to go to law school, right? That's I don't know. That's the kind of the beauty of what we do here. We break things down in pretty easy terms for our lawyer, law student listeners, plus just our general sports fan audience that want to know about this particular case. So again, sponsored by Themis, but you know, Themis is cool. They said, hey, we want everyone to know about your platform. So if more people want to sponsor us, totally cool with us. We are equal opportunity here. There's no discrimination here. Anybody can sponsor with us. Mike, so I guess for some scheduling, if you're looking at this in the podcast app, the next podcast that you will see is part two of the panel. And Mike and I are just going to have some brief back and forth in the beginning and the end, but then we'll go right to the material. Panel two, just so you can know what to expect, is Randy Carricker of ESPN 101. Derek King Sports is a, you know, he's an independent journalist, but he's been following the story very closely. We wanted to put him on the panel as kind of like the voice of the fan, but he's been following this as a journalist. But, you know, we wanted to get that type of passion up on the panel. Ben Albrighton, who is the sports media in Denver, big name. Obviously, you've heard of him. Grew up in St. Louis, has some connections to some very powerful people in St. Louis, is why you also might have heard him, why you had him on the panel. And also Tim McKernan. He had so much fun on the first panel, he came back for number two. So if you enjoyed what you heard here, take a peek at number two, or panel number two that we'll be at now, called the St. Louis Jury. Mike, anything else before we put this in the books?
No, excited for panel two.
Okay. I am Dan Lust. I'm at Sports Law Lust. Mike is at Mike_son_of_law. Dan Wallach is at Wallach Legal. We, as the podcast, are at Con Detrimental, and our website, conductdetrimental.com. For us, we will see you in about 2 minutes on panel two of the St. Louis Rams relocation lawsuit. Until then.